From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. This week, we seek answers to our domestic troubles by looking east to Poland, a country wrestling with disinformation, xenophobia, and a battle over its own story.
The assumption that we had finished with those arguments and that we'd all learned the lessons of the Second World War or whatever piece of history you want to point to was wrong.
Poland's new Holocaust speech law. It was passed this year and it bans any claims that the country collaborated with Nazi Germany during World War II.
4 years ago, I believed that I lived in a democratic country which is in the heart of Europe.
This is not a problem that should be given to the public prosecutor, but rather to educators. The proper answer to ignorance is education.
Okay, so these elections were won by illiberals, but we should hope and work for the future, and we should win next elections.
It's all coming up after this.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is out this week. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This month's impeachment hearings have laid bare the dynamic at the heart of our current political standoff. Former Director for Russia and Europe at the National Security Council, Fiona Hill.
The impact of the successful 2016 Russian campaign remains evident today. Our nation is being torn apart. Truth is questioned.
Disinformation and the breakdown of truth. We see its effects everywhere.
So once you get to Ukraine, you see the real problem is not foreign interference. The real problem is Clinton interference.
There is buku, as we say in Louisiana, evidence that Ukraine tried to meddle in the 2016 election.
How can the same people all last week in the mob and the media be so outraged that President Trump were doing nothing, zip, yet totally, completely ignored the biggest slam dunk case that Hunter Biden, he was making millions and millions of dollars serving on the board of a corrupt Ukrainian oil and gas company.
Other prominent Republicans, including the president, continue to sow doubt and challenge established facts.
And I still want to see that server. You know, the FBI has never gotten that server. That's a big part of this whole thing. Why did they give it to a Ukrainian company?
Are you sure they did that? Are you sure they gave it to Ukraine?
Well, that's what the word is.
Last week, Vox's David Roberts warned us about where we could end up when we give in to conspiracies and lies.
You know, the other way things can go is if this sort of cultish, increasingly authoritarian movement takes over the country. In Russia and Turkey and Poland, right? It's a disturbingly longer and longer list. We see countries that we thought were democracies devolve into this. In the U.S., so much has happened in the last few years that we thought would never happen. I think we should really loosen up our imaginations as to what can happen when a movement that is convinced that everything it knows and loves is in danger of falling apart, a movement that's thinking like that, unconnected anymore to facts or reality, and got its hands on the power of the federal government, is the basic recipe for democracies falling apart.
And so, this week, OTM producer Leia Feder takes us to one of those places. Poland, a young democracy teetering on shaky ground. There she had a close-up look at how and why its far-right nationalist government is intent on rewriting the nation's painful history.
For almost a decade, Poland has been in the grip of a conspiracy theory. What really happened when a plane crashed in a forest in western Russia, killing Poland's president and dozens of other government officials? The plane had been en route to commemorate another Polish tragedy, a massacre that had occurred in the very same location in 1940. A 1973 documentary explored the mystery.
While the German armies advanced from the west, the Soviets crossed Poland's eastern frontiers. Caught in a massive pincer, the Polish army collapsed and surrendered. The victors divided the country down the middle and imprisoned every soldier they captured. Russia took over 200,000. 15,000, half Poland's officer corps, were never seen alive again. Many were to die near Smolensk, in a forest called Kachin.
After decades of opacity and suspicion, an investigation in the early 90s confirmed, finally, that it was not Hitler, but Stalin who had ordered the massacre. And so when, on April 10th, 2010, a delegation of 96 Polish politicians and officials traveled from Warsaw to Smolensk, it was in service of remembrance and reconciliation. But what happened instead compounded the national pain.
Poland's prime minister burst into tears when he heard the news today that his country's president was killed in a plane crash.
The pilot tried to land in a thick fog at least twice, missing the runway and ignoring the control tower's direction to divert to another city.
Not just losing the president of that country, the first lady, the head of the army chief of staff, the national security office head, deputy parliament speaker, the deputy foreign minister.
It was a devastating national tragedy. What's more, the symbolic layering was undeniable. A long-standing tragedy finally solved, and a new one appears in its place. And yet,
in the immediate moments and days after the crash, there was a kind of common shock.
Anna Applebaum is a journalist and academic based in Warsaw. At the time of the 2010 crash, her husband was Minister of Foreign Affairs in the Polish government.
And there was pretty straightforward reporting about what had happened, what was immediately clear. There were people on the ground who saw the crash. So there was a kind of consensus initially about what had happened, that it was a terrible accident and that, you know, many people of value to the nation had died.
But the story started to shift as the investigation into the crash proceeded.
Investigators say pilot error was mostly to blame.
It became clear that one of the causes of the crash was the fact that the pilots were under pressure to land. The president's delegation had arrived late for the plane. They were running behind schedule. As they got closer to Smolensk, which wasn't even really an airport, it was a kind of airstrip in the forest, they began to be worried about the fog.
And the pilots weren't sure they could make the narrow landing. But according to black box recordings, Polish President Lech Kaczynski, head of the opposition party, directed the pilots to do it.
It was meant to be the launch of his re-election campaign. So there were cameras there, which he knew, and he was very anxious to go.
Under pressure, the pilots tried to make the landing. Instead, they hit a tree, killing all 96 people on board.
The president's twin brother, the head of the nationalist right political party in Poland, the same party as the president, he didn't like this story. It made the president look bad. More to the point, this was a terrible crash, very near to a place where an earlier generation of Poles were murdered by the Soviet state. Because of that eeriness, people immediately began to speculate that there was actually a different, deeper story, that perhaps the Russians caused the crash, perhaps there was a bomb on the plane. And conspiracy theories began to proliferate online. The president's brother, Jarosław Kaczynski, began openly alluding to them.
Kaczynski's Law and Justice Party made unraveling the Smolensk conspiracy its key campaign promise.
Once you had bought into their idea that there was a secret conspiracy, possibly involving the Polish prime minister, Donald Tusk, possibly involving the Russians, and that lots of people high up in the state were implicated in some great big secret plot to kill the president. If you believe that, then you can believe a lot of other things. The point was to get people to believe in a kind of alternative reality, to doubt institutions, to doubt that the government was telling them the truth. And that was absolutely an attempt to help win an election.
But it did more than carve out a new electorate. It created new divides in Polish society. Where once Polish politics were split between communists and anti-communists or around economic policy, now it was over a vision of history.
It was how you see Poland's place in the world and whether you think secret dark forces are trying to undermine your country and whether, you know, you need to elect a government of patriots in order to make sure that doesn't happen. Where you fell on that dividing line affected how you would vote and how you would understand politics for the next several years.
And so, when Law and Justice won in 2015, it spawned a new kind of power, a power based on the willingness to embrace the myth.
They fired large numbers of Polish civil servants, Polish members of the Foreign Service, all kinds of people who work for the government, also leaders and board members of state companies. And they replaced all of them with people whom they were sure were loyal. And one element of the loyalty test was belief in the Smolensk myth.
The Smolensk conspiracy implied that there were dark, mysterious forces continuing to try to manipulate and undermine the Polish nation. It also drew on the larger story of a Poland continually attacked by outsiders and the valiant Polish resistance to threats past and present. Law and Justice rode that narrative to electoral victory, and then rode its electoral victory to further consolidation of that narrative in service of Polish nationalism. Coming up, a right-wing nationalist party comes to power. Its first takeover, the museums. This is On the Media.
This is Brooke. When you've finished listening to OTM this week, why don't you head over to the New Yorker Radio Hour? David Remnick sat down with Jerry Seinfeld, who just directed his first movie about Pop-Tarts.
Did you really like Pop-Tarts all that much growing up?
Oh, yeah.
How about now?
Still, yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I love them.
That's a good breakfast for you?
I eat it after a bad show on a Wednesday night.
Listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour.
So do what Brooke says. Come join us for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Leah Fetter. Poland is a nation haunted by its 20th century.
Poland, September 1939. The German foe begins its ruthless march of conquest and sets the stage for World War II. Poland's 34 million inhabitants, crushed, scattered, and enslaved. Tens of thousands of square miles of territory shrink before the movement of lightning-armored columns. Poland and the world learn the meaning of a grim new word, Blitzkrieg.
Germany and the Soviet Union each invaded and occupied Poland during World War II, killing in the process some 5.6 million Poles, including 3 million Polish Jews. After the war, Poland became an independent republic within the Soviet bloc under communist rule. In 1989, it was one of the first of the Eastern European nations to break away and become a democracy. For decades, the nation has wrestled with the complicated question of how to interpret its own history. And so, in 1998, Poland founded its Institute of National Remembrance, whose motto is, "Our history creates our identity."
The Institute for National Remembrance was initially a place where historians could pursue questions that other historians weren't pursuing.
Janine Holk is a professor of political science at Loyola University, Maryland, where her focus is Eastern Europe.
Some of these questions involved, for example, Stalinist crimes in Poland. So there was a lot of attention being given to the Holocaust and crimes against Jews. And here was a place where they could pursue questions about crimes by the Soviet Union and the Soviet Union's representatives against Poland. So it was a place where history was being done consciously with a sense of, can we fill in gaps? Can we find archival sources and collect archival sources that other historians aren't doing?
But within a few years of its founding, the question of what history exactly needed to be examined became a bit more complicated, with the 2001 publication of a book called Neighbors by then NYU professor Jan Gross. Neighbors told the story of the 1941 Jedwabne massacre, in which hundreds of Polish Jews were massacred by their Polish neighbors in a fashion too gruesome to repeat on this program. And it set into motion a national reckoning. President Aleksander Kwaśniewski in 2001.
We can have no doubt that here in Jedwabne, Polish citizens were killed at the hands of fellow citizens.
He continued, for this crime, we should beg for forgiveness from the souls of the dead and their families. This is why today, as both a citizen and president of the Republic of Poland, I apologize. For some other Poles, it was too bitter a pill to swallow. These citizens chose to see their nation as solely a victim of Nazi atrocities. Law and Justice, then a nascent right-wing party of the anti-communist right, took a stand against what it called the politics of shame. Party leader Jarosław Kaczyński's position has never wavered.
This whole pedagogy of shame, this push to accept guilt, has led to a situation where our nation has to face the unthinkable. I mean, our nation has to fight to stop accusations that we are guilty of the horrors of World War II.
At the time, Jarosław's brother Lech Kaczyński, the Law and Justice leader who would later serve as president and then perish in the Smolensk crash, was mayor of Warsaw, where he led the construction of a world-renowned museum that offered a more valiant story of Polish resistance. It's called the Warsaw Rising Museum, named for the 63-day military operation started in the summer of 1944, in which the Polish Home Army fought to wrest control of Warsaw from the Nazis. With no outside assistance, the Poles were defeated. 200,000 people died.
Germans bombed and shelled sections held by the Poles and finally were able to move tanks and heavy equipment into the recaptured city. The two-month-long revolt was a bloody and heroic battle, and starving Poles stripped dead horses for food. Forced to capitulate when no help came, the Poles signed an armistice with the Nazis.
When the museum opened, Paweł Machcewicz was working at the Institute of National Remembrance, which had dutifully investigated the Jedwabne massacre. To him, the Warsaw Rising Museum revealed some of the tensions to come.
It was only about the glory, the heroism, and not so much about the political and especially human price that was paid for this heroism. 200,000 people were killed during the uprising, and the great majority of them civilians. For me, it was one of the greatest tragedies in the Polish history, and we should, of course, commemorate this event, but I think that our obligation is also to discuss the price that was paid for this heroism and also all the political context, why the decision to start the uprising was taken. Was it a wise decision? Was it a huge mistake, perhaps? All that was ignored in this exhibition. It was the first exemplification of the politics of history of law and justice. Not yet on the national level, but on the level of Warsaw, on the level of the capital of Poland.
He favored a more nuanced view of Poland's World War II experience, and in 2007 published an article in the liberal daily paper Gazeta Wyborcza, proposing another museum, one that would be built in Gdansk and tell the overall narrative about the Second World War.
A very broad picture of the past, not hiding sensitive parts of our history. And also the museum should somehow provoke visitors to think, to have their own reflection upon the past. My idea was that we should, of course, present the Polish history, but also the history of other nations who suffered in the war, who fought in the war.
And that idea got some serious pushback.
I thought, and I still think, that the best way to make people from abroad understand our history is to present this history against a broader background. And only against this broader international background, the specific features of a Polish history could be understood.
To leaders on the right, this dismissal of Polish exceptionalism was an attempt to destroy the nation in service of a foreign agenda. The intended museum's decision to focus more on civilians than the military was also denounced.
The Second World War was different from all previous conflicts because it affected mostly the civilians. And in the Polish case, it was even more striking because 90% of Polish citizens who died in the war were civilians. This approach was also rejected. It was labeled as pacifistic, as somehow denigrating the achievements of the Polish soldiers. And this criticism of this concept and later on of our exhibition that we created in Gdańsk was focusing on this allegedly too humanistic, too pacifistic and anti-war approach of our exhibition.
And yet, despite all this, the museum moved forward. The design was singular. A green landscaped plaza surrounding a bright red complex that featured a 40-meter tipped tower rising to the sky, representing the future and housing the museum's educational facilities. The permanent exhibition itself, all 50,000 square feet of it, would be underground, below the complex, a nod to the ways in which history forms the foundation of our world, below the surface. The experience of the museum was to feel both enlightened and entombed, ringed by tall walls of concrete and pulled in by video, touchscreens, wall text, and original artifacts, through which the museum sought to convey both civilian suffering and resistance, and drawing parallels across time and place.
We have a huge section of the exhibition devoted to the occupation of Europe and of Asia by Germany, by the Soviet Union, by Japan. We have also a huge section of the exhibition devoted to the Holocaust, and this is about not only what happened in Poland, but about many other nations. Our approach was that we tried to include as much as possible about Poland and Eastern Europe within the exhibition, but we tried to make it in a consistent way a part of a broader story. So every visitor would notice that Poland is present, in fact, everywhere in this exhibition, but always in connection with other nations, with other cases of terror, of extermination, of resistance.
Several years and tens of millions of dollars later, it was almost ready. But in 2015, Law and Justice won the national elections. Machcevich and his team were just months from the opening when in April 2016, word came down from the central government that the museum would be liquidated and merged with the Museum of Westerplatte and the War of 1939, a museum in Gdansk that had not yet been built.
The museum did not employ a single employee, but did not have an address, did not have even a telephone number. And on this Friday night, it was announced that the biggest historical museum in Poland, the Museum of the Second World War, which was almost ready to be open to the public, would simply disappear, swallowed by a fictional ghost museum.
Machcevich had the multi-year contract guaranteed to all museum directors in Poland. Firing him outright would have been illegal. The so-called merger was a ruse. But since there was a legally mandated 3-month waiting period before any liquidations or mergers, Machcevich worked to speed up construction and shore up his base.
Despite all the obstacles created by the government, we worked in an incredible pace, trying to speed up everything. And at the same time, we were attacked by the law and justice propaganda, by the law and justice politicians, and we were accused of being not real Poles, of acting on the orders of Berlin or Brussels.
Machcevich was accused of financial irregularities. Jarosław Kaczyński declared on TV that the museum was not a Polish museum, but one imposed by Germany upon Poland.
The World War II Museum in Gdańsk, a sort of gift to Angela Merkel from Donald Tusk, is nothing more than an endorsement of Germany's politics of history.
In the meantime, protesters came out to show their support for Machcevich, and he and his team mounted legal challenges. In late March 2017, the museum opened. But only 2 weeks later, a letter came down from the Supreme Administrative Court giving the Minister of Culture full license to do with it what it wanted.
The museum was eventually liquidated. I was not even fired because simply the museum whose director I was ceased to exist. The Minister of Culture on the same day founded the new museum of the Second World War, but the name was the same. But legally, it was a new institution of culture. So the new director was nominated. On the first day in office, he declared that the exhibition would be changed.
At the time, Agnieszka Siroka was training as a tour guide at the museum. She and dozens of other guides had been preparing for months. But when the management changed, the guides were presented with a choice. Sign a document stating that they would follow the museum's new script, no editorializing, or leave.
You either sign it or no. And those who did sign could, you know, follow the path.
Why did you refuse to sign?
Along with the historical facts that you can read from the label, being a guide is also my opinion and my attitude and myself in this. And I didn't want to be forced to change the history.
And when you refused to sign, what happened?
So the moment you don't sign, you didn't get the proper ID to enter the exhibition. Yeah, you know, there are guards at the entrance. So we were informed that these guides who are not approved by the new management won't have the IDs to enter. So if you want to enter, you have to buy yourself a ticket.
About 2/3 of the guides refused to sign. And about 6 months after taking over, the new management began instituting changes to the exhibitions. Agnieszka says the changes in the museum's narrative have been hard to watch.
You know, there was a balance in this museum. There were good Poles and bad Poles. Now, in the museum, there are only good Poles.
There were almost 20 new elements introduced or some elements of the exhibition that were removed.
Paweł Machcewicz.
All these changes implement a certain vision of the history, and they go in two directions. One about removing these parts of the exhibition which are regarded as too international, and the second, adding new elements. A new installation was added about Poles saving Jews, and it suggests that Poles saved over 100,000 Jews, and historians know that this is a false number because not more than 30 to 50,000 Jews even survived the German occupation in the occupied Poland. The most invasive, the most aggressive change, this is removing of the film that was presented in the last room of the exhibition. It was a sort of a footage of archival films and archival photographs about wars, conflicts, violence that happened after the end of the Second World War until nowadays.
Czy w Polsce są żydowscy nacjonaliści? Towarzysze, na pewno tak odpowiadam.
The film begins with news of the end of the Nuremberg trials, followed by an announcement about Stalin, and then by globe-spanning shots from the Korean War, East Berlin, the UK, Turkey, from Martin Luther King and Occupy Wall Street. The final scenes depict the wars in Ukraine and Syria, and refugees.
This film was criticized by the right wing as too pacifistic, anti-war, and the new director of the museum declared that the museum should somehow encourage Poles to defend their country instead of presenting the war as a great tragedy.
The film that replaced it has a different tone.
Nobody thought the war and its effects would last half a century for Poland. First, Germany attacks. Then Soviet Russia. We don't give up, despite being left on our
own. It continues in this vein until its rousing end.
Workers' strikes spread throughout Poland. The communists lose. The Iron Curtain falls. The war is over. We prevail. Because we do not beg for freedom, we fight for it.
It's not strictly a lie. It's Poland's story through a tightly focused lens, seen today in the World War II Museum in Gdansk, open to the public under the leadership of the Law and Justice Party. Leadership from which we unsuccessfully sought comment many times. Meanwhile, Poland's culture war rages around another institution.
Poland, the Warsaw Museum for the History of Polish Jews, is currently looking for a new director. The culture minister has a say in who will get the job, and he's looking for someone who wants to improve on, as he calls it, historical policy.
Poland's museum director Dariusz Stola sits in limbo. After his first five-year term as director, an independent committee asked him to stay on for another five. But to make it official, his appointment must be approved by the country's Minister of Culture, Piotr Gliński. Glinski hasn't done it, nor explained why. But there are theories. In 2018, the Polish government passed an amendment related to history.
Poland's new Holocaust speech law. It was passed this year, and it bans any claims that the country collaborated with Nazi Germany during World War II. Specifically, the legislation prohibits references to wartime Nazi death camps in the country as being Polish. Those in violation of that law face up to 3 years behind bars.
After outcry from the international community, the amendment was tempered. The law demoted from a criminal to a civil offense, with violators no longer risking jail time. Dariusz Stola was among those who criticized the law.
This is not a problem that should be given to the public prosecutor, but rather to educators. That the proper answer to ignorance is education.
So that's one theory for why Stola's appointment is on hold. Here's another. Last March, Poland hosted an exhibit called Estranged, looking at the March 1968 anti-Semitic campaign to purge Poland of its Jews once and for all, during which roughly 13,000 Jews were driven out. In the exhibit featured on the Pauline website, friends wander through an exhibit and are disappeared one by one, while the anti-Semitic words of Władysław Gomułka, the communist leader of Poland from 1956 to 1970, drone in the background. The exhibit ends at a wall of anti-Semitic quotes from 1968 and 2018, at least two of which belong to members of the Law and Justice Party. Meanwhile, Stola's reappointment as museum director is still unsigned. Paweł Machcewicz.
The law does not say how much time the Minister of Culture has got to sign the contract, because it seemed quite obvious to everyone when this law was adopted that it should happen without any delay. And it's already approximately half a year after Dariusz Stola was elected by the jury to become the director of this museum.
Monuments and museums, especially those that trace a nation's past as a story, often are prey to political argument. Call it a testament to their continued relevance. Especially the increasingly popular narrative museums that array artifacts, photographs, and installations to illuminate or to mislead. In Nagasaki, Japan, there's the Atomic Bomb Museum, where in 1996, material about the Japanese Army's 1937 murder of 250,000 Chinese war prisoners and civilians was removed. In Budapest, Hungary, there's the House of Terror, built to show parallels and continuity between Nazis and Hungarian fascists and the communists. But the museum dedicates only a fifth of its content to the war, despite the 500,000 Hungarian Jews murdered during the Holocaust, and makes no mention of Hungarian cooperation with the Nazis in sending Jews to Auschwitz. Machcewicz finds Poland's use of state-funded museums to retell history deeply worrying.
4 years ago, I believed that I lived in a democratic country, which is a part of the European Union, which is in the heart of Europe. I, of course, knew that the confrontation between historians and politicians could be difficult sometimes, but I could not foresee that my country would somehow slide into a sort of a hybrid regime, which is not anymore the liberal democracy, which is somehow moving towards a certain form of authoritarian regime, and that history and especially historical museums would be in the core of all the controversies, and that my life as a historian and as a citizen would almost overnight turn upside down, and that defending the autonomy of history, autonomy of the culture, which was something elementary, basic to me, would become quite a tough issue, which would be connected to a price that you have to pay for it.
And thus, the Institute of National Remembrance, where Machcewicz got his start and which was created to expose and examine the most uncomfortable parts of Poland's past, is now the cudgel of the Law and Justice Party, policing debates about Polish culpability and quashing party critics. Janine Holk.
As this nationalist government came to power, this institute began to, first of all, downplay any historical projects that the government did not support and amplify its role not only in publishing historical work, but then actually creating policy based on that historical work. So they were crucial in creating a policy in which citizens could look up other citizens' secret police files. The Institute for National Remembrance set up a process by which the government could identify individual citizens and then expose any of the files the secret police had on them, accusing them of being an informant, including dates and including people who they were accused of informing against. And this was an incredibly powerful tool because it could be used to delegitimize their political opponents, and they indeed used it for that.
As Law and Justice uses state institutions to censor and suppress, it nudges the country ever further from the tenets of pluralism and democracy.
This political party became very emboldened by the numbers of votes it was getting in the elections and the types of support it was seeing for its rhetoric. And from that emboldened stance, it has pursued a number of increasingly authoritarian policies. One of these is cracking down on academic freedom. Another one is cracking down on LGBT rights. And another one is being much more assertive about museums and public spaces in Poland and what they can and cannot show.
But with Poland no longer under existential threat from Germany or the Soviet Union, how does it sell its defensive nationalist posture? Anne Applebaum.
What they've tried to do is create threats. One of the threats they created famously was this threat of Syrian refugees. Far-right magazines put pictures of the refugees on the cover and sort of Muslims murdering Christians. And so I would say it had some effect in Poland, but it didn't last very long, partly because there aren't any refugees in Poland and there aren't really any who want to get in there. How long can you go on about a non-existent threat? The second thing they tried, which appears to have been more successful, was an argument that Poland is threatened by gay ideology coming from the West. They called LGBT, which actually makes it sound weird. I mean, people don't even know what LGBT stands for. That's an English acronym. But they use it in Polish, and it sounds like a weird disease from the West.
Law and Justice is using its control of Poland's historical narrative to shape its current and future one. The present story? One in which Poland stands apart from other nations, unique in the existential threats it faces. Threats the party believes exempt it from Europe's shared commitment to human rights. But obviously, Poland is not unique. Many nations claim similar hardships as they pursue similar paths. And not just in Europe. The lessons of Poland are relevant oceans away. Coming up, when the state controls the story, how can you tell a different one? This is On the Media.
Wziąć to, czego nie ma, dodać soli i kminku, potem zmieszać z tym, czego chwilowo brak na rynku. Mieszać długo i dokładnie, jak się znudzi.
This is On the Media. I'm Leah Fetter on the struggle for Poland's past and future. Before the anti-liberal right, there was liberal democracy, which took hold in Poland formally in the summer of 1989.
Poland appeared today on the verge of having a non-communist government. President Wojciech Jaruzelski met with Solidarity leader Lech Walesa.
A few years later, after the collapse of the Soviet bloc, political scientist Francis Fukuyama wrote a famous book called The End of History and the Last Man.
The end of history refers to the what I think still remains a question of whether that process is one that, you know, finally culminates in a certain kind of civilization.
Fukuyama on C-SPAN in 2001.
You know, the last civilization that mankind will achieve, because in a certain sense it's the, you know, it's the right one, it's the one that fits human nature. What I argue in the book is that liberal democracy comes much closer to fitting human nature in that sense than virtually any type of prior form of government or political organization or social organization.
It was a seductive idea that liberal democracy, which embraces human rights and equal protection along with popular representation, was humanity's natural landing point. But it's been severely challenged by the rise of illiberalism, a mindset that sees democracy as possible without those freedoms and protections. Democracy, in this view, is a winner-take-all game in which minority rights are subordinate and subject to the will of the majority. It restyles the, quote, will of the people into something fierce, absolutist, and it's a rising trend. Fareed Zakaria.
These two traditions, liberty and law on the one hand and popular participation on the other, became intertwined, creating what we call liberal democracy. But in a number of countries, from Hungary to Russia to Turkey to Iraq to the Philippines, the two strands have come apart. Democracy persists in many cases, but liberty is under siege.
In Poland, the past 4 years, the Liberal Law and Justice Party has subdued its judicial opponents and gained increasing control over the courts. It's enacted harsh measures against immigrants and the LGBT community. In 2016, it tried for a complete ban on abortion, but backed down after a wave of strikes. It's turned the state TV network into a party mouthpiece and become increasingly enmeshed with the Catholic Church.
but it's also done something else.
They have used economics.
Anne Applebaum.
Poland went from having one of the smaller welfare states in Europe to having it's either the largest or one of the top two or three as a proportion of GDP. They basically created a welfare state, and for people in the provinces, it was so generous that about 1 million people left the labor market altogether. It was a big economic giveaway.
The kind of giveaway usually associated with social democrats. Political analysts credit the success of Law and Justice to a secret sauce of xenophobia, nationalism, and those economic policies. Meanwhile, the battle for the future of Poland raged last summer in Warsaw, giving birth to a new left-wing political coalition. Lewica, Polish for left, allied Poland's three left-wing parties, Razem, SLD, and Spring. Until recently, they've been mostly on the fringes of a Polish political landscape divided between the far-right Law and Justice Party and the center-right Civic Platform. I went to Lewica's inaugural rally with Igor Stofiszewski, a literary critic and activist with the left-wing publication and network Krytyka Polityczna. A slight man with a shaved head in his 40s, he walked me by some buildings claimed by squatters in downtown Warsaw, occupied by a mix of locals and immigrants.
You have to turn right.
Okay.
Okay, so...
We pass a poster with the face of an older woman named Jolanta Breszka, an activist murdered in 2012, now a symbol of the housing movement in Warsaw.
At that time,
Igor says the city is plastered with them. Warsaw is a city with symbols of resistance throughout. A theater with the words feminism, not fascism, spray-painted across its marquee. And a mayor who's openly opposed to Law and Justice's central government.
He signed so-called LGBT charter, which proposes very concrete solutions for LGBT community to feel safe, and so on, so on. So,
the traffic got very loud here, but what he told me was that during the last round of municipal elections in October 2018, the opposition trounced Law and Justice. Turnout was up almost 20%, and although the ruling party made gains in rural areas, it won just 4 of the 107 mayoral races. It's a curious thing, this divide. On one hand, nationalism is on the rise, as evident at this month's annual Independence March, where tens of thousands of Poles took to the streets, and organizers chanted, "Glory to Great Poland and God, honor and homeland," from the stage. So is homophobia, evidenced when thousands of anti-gay protesters attacked the summer's LGBT Pride March in Bialystok. On the other hand, the October parliamentary elections failed to deliver Law and Justice a consolidated victory. Yes, the party retained national control, but it not only failed to achieve a constitutional majority, it lost the upper house of parliament, thus losing the ability to pass new laws. Lewica, the left-wing coalition, went from having no representatives in parliament to having 45. Here's Jarosław Kuis, editor-in-chief of the centrist media think tank Kultura Liberalna.
We have quite a new political narrative now that seems to be more pluralistic than for the last 4 years when we had only the opposition that was mainly from the camp of the previous government, more or less center-right, and the conservative nationalist right from the Law and Justice. So now it is more colorful.
Kuis gives some of the credit to the activism of the Polish opposition. But there's something else afoot. Right before the elections, Krytyka Polityczna and a couple other organizations released a study called Political Cynicism, the Case of Poland, which found that Law and Justice voters are not entirely aligned behind the idea of an unchecked majority for their party. After the elections, I checked back in with Igor, who explained that these voters are likely responsible for Law and Justice's electoral setbacks.
They have more trust in political pluralism than in their own party. So it is not the opposition or the oppositional voter who stopped Law and Justice from having a constitutional majority. It's a Law and Justice voter who stopped them.
Turns out that Law and Justice voters, like all voters, vary in the whys and wherefores of their party affiliation. The so-called old Law and Justice electorate, the hardliners, may be motivated by their loathing for intellectuals, Europe, and urban elites. But the new Law and Justice voters, those whose votes decided this election, are largely in it for the money, especially the government's ever-expanding child benefit. And in the run-up to the most recent election, yet more.
They announced they would distribute an extra month's pension, a kind of so-called 13th month, to all pensioners.
Anne Applebaum.
In the end, they got about 43% of the vote, of which I'd say about half is still true believers and half are people who liked the spending policy.
But obviously, these popular, populist policies come at a price.
I mean, it's come at the cost of investment. They've stopped investing in roads. They've stopped investing in the healthcare system. They're raising taxes.
All of which calls into question how long this particular strategy will continue to pay off. Law and justice voters are transactional, and transactional voters can shift for a better deal or a better story. The illiberal narrative seized and shaped by Law and Justice of exceptionalism and cultural encroachment, much like America's current White House story, has served it well. What's an effective liberal response?
Maybe we should talk about the last 30 years as the process of ups and the downs, because it would be less mythical.
Jaroslav Kuis is describing history not as the unvarnished glory of liberal democracy, but as an ongoing effort to gain and retain freedom.
We have the first generations of Poles that were born and brought up in their own independent state. Something like this did not happen since 18th century. If something is to be celebrated, it is that, I think. Now, you have a lot of young citizens that do not remember communism.
I know that the communist past has been manipulated in a lot of different ways, and particularly the anti-communist sentiment. I'm wondering if you think there's value in actually reclaiming some of that communist past.
I tend to think, after all those experiments with political history, that we should remember more. Mm-hmm. That it was a political mistake of liberals to leave the historical issues to the right. What could be the solution is to rather to teach how complex Polish history in the 20th century was and how it ended up eventually with this wonderful event of entering the European Union. And we should start to teach it to the new generations as a history that is very complex one. And then maybe we could have some conclusions for the future.
I mean, I would not say that we're definitely heading for authoritarianism.
Anne Applebaum.
Nor would I say that liberal democracy has won and we'll definitely beat this thing off and it'll be fine. I mean, this I think is now what politics is. The assumption that we had finished with those arguments and that we'd all learned the lessons of the Second World War or whatever piece of history you want to point to was wrong.
So now we enter the stage in which we have a kind of permanent battle and skirmishes one after another. It's not going to be the war that would be over here or there. It's like, okay, so these elections were won by illiberals, but we should hope and work for the future, and we should win next elections.
It was foolish to think a generation ago that we were at the end of history, and it would be equally foolish to think that the story is done now. In Poland, as in the United States, history is being wielded in service of opposing visions of the future. And the question of who will inherit the future, that comes down to who's willing to fight for it and what stories they tell. For On the Media, I'm Leah Fetter.
Next week, we return to American shores, where illiberalism has overtaken the Reagan-era coalition of tax cutters and foreign policy hawks, social conservatives and libertarians that made up the conservative movement. Here's a taste of my talk with Commonweal's Matthew Sitman, who's followed the debate on the American right. He says newly empowered illiberals declare that old consensus dead, and though they lack its big numbers, they don't think numbers matter anymore.
You don't see any of these intellectuals really appealing to democracy. They think they're entitled to power, but they also are not grappling with the fact that they might not really have a majority behind them.
There hasn't been a poll taken that suggests that they do.
Right. So we know Trump won 3 million fewer votes than Hillary Clinton. We know that due to gerrymandering and assaults on voting rights, Republicans have more representation in Congress than they should based on the amount of support they have. We know that our political institutions are fairly undemocratic, especially the Senate and the Electoral College. You can see a situation arising in which Republicans keep trying to hold on to power despite not being a majority, And my concern is that these conservative intellectuals are creating the conditions or giving themselves permission to go along with what amounts to authoritarian rule by a political party that doesn't have anywhere close to the support of a majority of Americans.
You quoted from Damon Linker, when social conservatives thought that they were the moral majority, it made sense for them to dream of exercising real political power. When they recognized that they were a minority, it made sense for them to resign themselves to adopting a defensive posture and preparing to live out their days in a country as dissenters from the reigning liberal consensus. What makes no sense is for social conservatives to think that they can be both weak and strong at the same time, a minority that wields the power of a majority. Unless, of course, social conservatives no longer care about democracy.
He put it very well, that the key is to implement the highest good, and the ways you get there matter less.
Next week, the rest of that conversation. This week's show was reported and produced by Leah Fetter. On the Media is also produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Micah Loewinger, John Hanrahan, and Asta Chaturvedi. We had more help from Charlotte Gartenberg, and our show was edited by me and Katya. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Sam Baer. Special thanks to WNYC archivist Andy Lancet, as well as Wojciech Olekshak and Victor Dinarski. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.